This is Digital Story Podcast number 1029, December 9th, 2025. Today's theme is Year-End Organizing Checklist for Photographers. I'm Derek Story. It's easy for photographers to be distracted by holiday sales as the year closes. Black Friday discounts and Cyber Monday deals are indeed tempting. But instead of focusing on acquiring new gear, this is a great time to manage what we already have. And that's what we're going to talk about on today's PBS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. Over the course of the previous 11 months, many of us bought new accessories, cameras, and lenses. Most likely we traveled to beautiful destinations and filled our SD cards with thousands of images. And if we're lucky, we even made a few dollars along the way. December is the perfect time to organize an account for all of that activity. Have you documented the serial numbers for your new gear? Is your backup system up to date? Do you know where your receipts are? Do you have any plans for the next year? This podcast can serve as a handy checklist to make sure your photography house is in order as we prepare to embark on 2026. Let's start with image backup and archiving. The thing is, not so much are you backing up and archiving, as much are you testing to see if your system works, right? And I think that is super important and something that we forget sometimes. For example, you know, we'll set up some sort of system maybe a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. And if we never test it, then how do we know it's going to work when we need it? And this is a perfect December activity. I think in terms of calendar year when organizing my images, and in part, this is how my brain works. So I'll soon be closing out 2025 and starting anew with 2026. This year's images have been backed up along the way, but now is the time to test my system to make sure it's as robust as I believe it to be. I have my images organized on an external RAID drive and a portable SSD. My favorite shots are saved in iCloud as an additional layer of convenience and protection. I can access my cloud account from any of my devices as long as I have my internet connection. For the connected drives, I use Peekto, P-E-A-K-T-O, to account for them and to provide a friendly user interface for managing the shots. I like it because it brings everything together from various locations into one easy-to-view location. But I put my system to the test by creating a list of shots that I want to find. And then I search for them. This is a strict pass-fail activity. If I don't recover 100% of the photos I have on that list, then I troubleshoot the system until I reach perfection. Now, this is also a great time to maybe reevaluate your system, take a look at the amount of storage you have available, review on how often you use the system to back up, like, if it's really easy to use, you're probably doing it more often. If it's more cumbersome, you're probably doing it less often. And when you're doing it less often, there's probably a bigger gap in between your backups, which mean those gaps are vulnerable spots in terms of protecting everything that you photograph. So it's a great time just to do an overall review of your system. But the main thing is test what you have now. Make sure that it works the way that you want it to, and if it doesn't, make the tweaks so that it does. Next up, serial numbers and updated insurance riders. It doesn't do any good to insure equipment that you've sold. December is the time to review your insurance riders, to delete items that you no longer own, and to add gear that you've acquired over the year. In addition to the policy itself, I keep an inventory list separately as well. Is your accounting woefully out of date? Shore it up now. It feels great to have everything itemized, plus now you have a platform to add additional information, such as purchase date, price, and even a photo of the item with a short description. That way, if you experience theft, fire, flooding, or some other loss, your inventory will help facilitate a fast recovery. This is one area that I am particularly bad at. I have insurance riders on my equipment, and I reviewed them the other day, and I'm going, wow, they are really out of date. And so what I needed to do was go back through, get the equipment that I've added since those insurance riders, delete the equipment that are no longer there, and just get the whole thing tidied up. Because let's say that I did have some sort of misfortune, knock on wood that I don't, but if I did, and then I discover that my insurance rider is way out of date, that I don't have an inventory list of all my items, I don't have serial numbers, all that stuff that is required in order to get a good recovery or to be compensated for what you've lost. This is probably my biggest, weakest area and something that I am definitely working on this December. Serial numbers and updated insurance riders. Number three, print your best pictures. We have no idea what the future has in store for us. Hard drives and computers could go the way of the dodo bird. A massive solar storm or cyber attack could erase everything. AI bots could go rogue. I know this sounds very sci-fi, but the reality is we just don't know what the future holds for us. Archival prints are immune from all of this. We don't need a device to view them. They have a long shelf life, and they're beautiful. If you were to make 6 prints every year of your best stuff, chances are good that you would have an entire exhibit archived by the time you retire. Think about it. If you wanted, you could erase every device you own and still have a collection of images left for posterity. I say if you haven't already, start this year by making at least 6 of the largest prints your printer can output. Store them in an archival box and mark the outside of the box clearly. Then next December, do it again. Or if you want to do it more often, absolutely yes, do it more often, but do it at least once a year. If you did that for only 5 years, you would have 30, at least 30, beautiful archival prints, some of your best stuff, right? Because that's what you're going to do, ready for the world or ready for you. You don't need a computer. You don't need a phone. You don't need a hard drive. You don't need anything to view them. All you need is to open the box, spread them on a table, and enjoy. I think it's one of the best archival systems ever, backup prints. And at the same time, it forces you through this exercise of going through your images from the year and really deciding which ones are your best shots. You know, you can use this as an opportunity to show images to friends and family, get their input, your photographer friends. You know, you could use it as an exercise to decide, hey, I thought this was my best stuff, but everybody really liked this shot, so I'm going to include that in my 6 prints. It's really quite amazing once you get involved with it. Make sure that you choose archival paper, and Red River Paper will help you do that. You can just look that up on their site. Make sure you get a box that is an archival box. They don't cost very much, but they won't harm your prints during storage. Keep them in a cool, dry place, as we all know. Keep them next to your medications, right? This is a terrific exercise, and I highly recommend it. Print your best pictures, store them archivally, and just let that collection grow over the years. Identify gear that you're not using. Our photography, like everything else, evolves over time. We find new areas of interest and perhaps become less enamored with previous favorites. Our gear will reflect those changes. We're pretty good about adding new items to accommodate fresh interests, but the old stuff tends to migrate to the back of the closet, out of sight. Since we have to pull everything out anyway to account for updating our inventory, why not use this opportunity to designate lesser used items for sale. Not only does this save space and simplify inventory control, but those extra dollars can go into future purchases for new things that we need. When I do something like this, when I find some equipment that I'm not using and I do decide to sell it or move it along, sometimes you can donate it, you can give it to a local school. There's all sorts of things that you can do with it. I do make sure that I record the serial number and the model number and all the stuff of the stuff that I've moved along just because. So my inventory list consists of the stuff that's currently here at the studio or at the house, but then also it includes the stuff that I've moved along just in case I ever need that for some sort of reference. Now, if you do sell it instead of donate it, then you can use that money to go into a little kitty fund where when you do need something new, you need a new accessory, a new lens, something like that, or even for travel expenses to help defer travel expenses, then you have some money already there that is really like a bonus, right? I've got whatever, let's say $350 there that I can use to help defer the cost of that $500 lens, and suddenly it's only $150. And I think also just overall, the process of moving things along that you're not using is a very healthy process. Because if we don't do that, if everything is just coming in and nothing is going out, it doesn't take long to do the math of how that works out. You end up with way too much stuff. And when you have way too much stuff, it's a much more daunting task to thin it out than it is if you do it as you go along. Just do it as you go along. It's good to have an outflow as well as an inflow. It's just healthier. It just keeps things from building up. And in the end, you won't get buried in equipment and you'll feel okay about getting new equipment if you're moving along older equipment. And finally, make plans for the new year, for 2026. Once you have your 2025 under control, it's time to think about the coming year. Do you have a project that you've been thinking about? Now is the perfect time to sketch it out, add milestones, and set your goal. Is there a destination that you've wanted to photograph? December is a great time to research the best times to visit that destination, to create budgets, and to start discussions with your travel partner. Blocking out space on the calendar for your adventures and goals not only increase the likelihood of them materializing, but it also reveals the open spaces that you have for other activities. It's a lot easier to agree to attend a family gathering in July when you know that month is open. Your trips are in the spring and in the fall. July's open. Yes, I'd love to attend. Plus, what a great feeling to have events to look forward to. And folks talk about this regarding our workshops all the time. You know, people put their deposits down, generally speaking, in November and December for the following year. And then they have something on the books. They have something to look forward to. It's great having an upcoming adventure. I know for people like me, half the fun is planning and getting ready for the adventure. I'm one of those weird people. I love packing as well. You know, I take packing very seriously and I start on it about a week ahead of time. You know, all those elements of an upcoming adventure are a great enjoyment for me and they really extend the pleasure of the adventure itself. December is a fantastic time to get those gears turning, to get those wheels turning so that you can start planning what you're going to do in 2026, and then take care of all the details to make it happen. So final thoughts on this. Photographers living north of the equator may think of December as an uninspiring time of short, cold days. But there's great opportunity to plant seeds for the coming year. Set aside the time to work on this checklist and have a great 2026. And let me just go over that checklist again. Number one, protect the work that you've done. Test your backup system. Number two, serial numbers, and updated insurance riders. Account for all of your gear. Number 3, print your best pictures. Create your device-independent archive. Number 4, identify the gear that you're not using, reclaim space, and generate income. And number 5, make plans for the new year. Block out chunks of time for your craft. I hope you find this checklist useful, and I hope you start working on it and getting ready for the new year. I've got some news for you. This is our news of the week. Oh, here's a post on DP Review. The best and worst photo gifts DP Review readers have ever received. I have a link to this article in the show notes. I'm not going to cover all of it, but I'm going to cherry pick a few things here. And then the rest of it is waiting for you over on DP Review. We are officially entering the season of gift giving, so it's only fitting that our most recent community-based question of the week was focused on presents. Last week, we asked you what is the best and worst photo-related gifts that you've received. We wanted to know what you've loved receiving, as well as the gifts that perhaps missed the mark. I'm going to start with practical is best. As we talked in our recent team discussion, practical gifts are often the best option. These are items that photographers will use constantly, like a tripod, a subscription, or another type of accessory. One person wrote, "The best gift I received, a universal L bracket from RRS. Not expensive or anything, but so useful on several of my camera bodies." Someone else wrote, "Several decades back, my wife gave me a green Lopro camera case for Christmas. I still have it and use it today. It's been many places and in many different weather conditions. It has served as my only carry-on on just about every flight. Great case, great wife." Another reader wrote, "The best by far was a decent Chinese tripod that still works after all these years and has proved perfectly sufficient for a phone. I even adapted it to Arca Swiss." And then we get into stay away from the novelty items. Another common thread throughout your responses was that gift givers should stay away from novelty items. They often end up sitting on a shelf or going in the bin, so that money could be better used on something else in most situations. The first one that we have here, "The worst gift I received was a lens ball crystal sphere. It's not a bad thing, just something that I didn't find useful. I have kept it, and though I don't find much use for it, I do take it out once or twice a year to capture a couple images to give to the person who gifted it to me. They appreciate that." Sweet person though, right? Another person wrote, "A cousin of mine had the sweet thought of gifting me a set of clip-on lenses for my mobile phone. It was a considerate gesture, being a hobbyist, but alas, me having no interest whatsoever in mobile phone photography, I tried the set as a curiosity and then stored it, and it finally ended up in the bin after a while." Oh, that's kind of sad, isn't it? And then finally I have, "The worst gift I've received was a green tie with cartoon cameras on it." Okay. How about lens mugs? They're controversial. There were quite a few of you who have received one of the rather infamous mugs that are made to look like a lens. Unfortunately, most of you are not fans, but one of you saw it as a very thoughtful gift. Here's the first one. "The worst I was given was a lens mug that was a Canon clone. It seems Nikon lens mugs are totally impossible to find these days." Another person wrote, "On more than one occasion, I received one of those confounded zoom lens coffee mugs that were designed to resemble a EF 24-105L lens. And each time I had to feign thanks as if I didn't have a cupboard full of them already. They were stupid as coffee mugs, way too big, but then there was the double indignity of being a Nikon shooter. I even heard stories of people breaking into cars to steal what they thought was a camera lens, but it turned out to be one of those moronic mugs." Oh my. Okay, here's another one. It's the first night of Hanukkah, a time to light candles and sing a song and exchange gifts. Out comes this B&H box with a bow. Not wrapped like they usually do, but who cares? I picked it up. It doesn't have the heft, but again, who cares? I open the box, and there is a Canon lens box. My heart pounds. My eyes water. Sharon, you shouldn't have. When I open the box, the expected addition to my lens collection turns out to be a cup. No disappointment. Lots of love and amazement. How did she come up with the most appropriate gift? I love her and my cup. See, we end on a high note there, right? All right, here's a little advice for us to close with. Finally, some of you suggested being very specific in your gift requests as photographers. We can be a tricky lot to please. After all, in lots of gear is system dependent. Providing specific links or product names or even just asking for money or gift cards could be the safest way to go to ensure a gift that will actually be enjoyed and used. One person wrote, "In my family, everyone knows to only gift me photo gear I have hinted about. And by hinted, I mean they have the specific item and product numbers." Another wrote, "Last year, I gave my husband a few links of Viltrox lenses, including the 35mm that I knew I wouldn't get, but really wanted, because we don't spend over $300 on gifts for each other. I'm now enjoying the lens." And finally, "I haven't had any bad gift experiences because I now tell people if they want to get me something photography-related for Christmas, just give me a gift card. Partially because I'm picky when it comes to lenses and cameras. I like to try them out in person before buying, and if they're used, I definitely want to be involved in that process. But for the past 8 years or so, I've gotten gift cards, which is really what I want anyway. That way, I can decide when to spend the money and on what." So there you go. You know, we are a difficult lot to buy for, aren't we? We're so specific about everything. And I'm the same way. I am absolutely the same way. In our family, if there's anything photography related, we do use links. Links are the best way to go. Just, you know, put the product name, put the link exactly to it. And then what we do is we create an oversized list so that if the person that is buying you a gift picks one of the items, you're not going to know which one it is because there's like five or six things on there. They pick one item, and then it is a surprise when you open the box. Crazy photography facts you probably didn't know. This is an article on F-stoppers, and I have a link in the show notes. I'm just going to read you a few of these. There are a bunch of them here. Let's start with, your camera sensor only sees in black and white. Here's a fact that surprises many photographers. The pixels on your sensor, called photodiodes, are completely colorblind. They can only measure the quantity of light hitting them, not its color or wavelength. So how does your camera produce color images? The solution in most digital cameras is a color filter array, usually a Bayer pattern, and a microscopic grid of red, green, and blue filters placed directly over the sensor. Each pixel gets exactly one filter placed on top of it, either red, green, or blue, limiting that photosite to detecting only a single wavelength range. The camera's image processor then performs demosaicing, a computational process that interpolates these separate color readings into full color pixels. It's essentially making an educated guess about what colors should be in each spot based on the surrounding filtered pixels. The better the algorithm, the more accurate the final color. All right, well, that one's pretty interesting, but we have more. There are twice as many green pixels on your sensor. The Bayer pattern isn't an even split of red, green, and blue. The standard arrangement groups for photosites together, two dedicated to green, with the remaining two split between red and blue. That means 50% of your sensor is dedicated to capturing green light. Why the green bias? because human vision is most sensitive to wavelengths in the green part of the spectrum. Our eyes evolved to be particularly good at distinguishing different shades of green, probably because our ancestors needed to spot predators hiding in foliage and identifying edible plants. By dedicating half of the sensor's pixels to green, camera manufacturers produce images that look cleaner and more detailed to our eyes. The green channel also typically carries the most luminance information, making it critical for perceived sharpness. Two green pixels, one blue, one red. The word bokeh was popularized by a photo magazine editor. The Japanese word bokeh means blur or haze, and Japanese photographers had been using it for decades to describe out-of-focus areas in photographs. But it wasn't part of the English photography vocabulary until 1997, when Mike Johnston, the editor of Photo Techniques magazine, introduced the spelling bokeh in his article, B-O-K-E-H. Johnston argued that the English word blur was too generic and didn't capture the specific aesthetic quality of out-of-focus rendering. He added the H to the spelling to encourage English speakers to pronounce it correctly. The term caught on quickly in the photography community and is now a permanent part of global photography lexicon. Today, lens reviews routinely evaluate bokeh quality, and it's become a major selling point for portrait and telephoto lenses. All right, let's do one more. There are a bunch of them here in the article. I'm going to do one more. The JPEG is named after the committee that created it. You've probably saved thousands of JPEG files without ever thinking about what the acronym stands for. JPEG, or JPG, which is just a shortened DOS-era file name, doesn't describe the technology. It's an acronym for Joint Photographic Experts Group, the committee of engineers and academics who created the compression standard back in 1992. The committee continues to exist and has developed other standards like JPEG 2000 and JPEG XL. The original JPEG format became so successful because it could dramatically reduce file sizes with minimal visible quality loss, making it perfect for the early internet. The compression works by dividing the image into 8x8 pixel blocks and using mathematical transformations to discard information that the human eye is less likely to notice. That's why heavy JPEG compression creates those characteristic blocky artifacts. So there's a little bit of camera trivia that you may or may not have known. And finally today, I want to mention something for X100 photographers. Viltrox teases new conversion lenses for the Fujifilm X100 cameras. And this is on Digital Camera World, and I have a link in the show notes. Viltrox looks to set to launch two new conversion lenses for the Fujifilm X100 series cameras. Currently, little is known about them apart from teaser images released on the official Viltrox Webio page, but they seem to be pretty close to copies of Fujifilm's own telephoto conversion lens and its wide conversion lens. Fujifilm's lenses are well regarded, but they have relatively steep $400 price tags. Viltrox's equivalents provide the same focal length conversions and are almost guaranteed to cost significantly less. Given our experience with other Viltrox lenses, we'd wager optical quality will be impressive too. The official launch is set for December 10th, when we'll hopefully be given full details of each conversion lens, along with pricing and availability. I'm actually kind of excited about this. I got the wide angle conversion from Fujifilm, but I didn't get the 50mm because I just didn't want to spend the money. So if Viltrox comes up with something on the telephoto side, I am definitely interested. All right, let's take care of a little Virtual Camera Club news. I want to mention our 2026 photography workshop season. We're featuring webinars, online workshops, and in-person events focused on creating impactful images in the company of those who love photography as much as you. Our workshops are like no others, and we think you will thoroughly enjoy the camaraderie and the tips and techniques. You can learn more about our lineup, online, webinar, in person, by visiting the Nimble Photographer website and clicking on workshops, or clicking on workshops in the upper nav bar on the digital story. And I hope to see you in one of our events in 2026. A big thanks to our Inner Circle members. These are the folks that support our podcast, our community, month in and month out. They also receive discounts on all of the workshops that I just mentioned. And I found that Inner Circle members, when they join, they have that discount. It doesn't cost them very much to be part of the Inner Circle. They tend to be more active because they have those benefits. And therefore, they have that little extra motivation to sign up for a workshop and receive a discount, to sign up for a webinar that is free to Inner Circle Bold members, or to sign up for an in-person workshop and get a big discount for that event. It's just a small way to say thanks to our Inner Circle members for supporting this community and keeping us moving forward. And finally, a big shout out to our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the digital story. I mentioned making archived prints of your best work at the end of each year. Go to the Red River Paper site, look up archive papers, take a look at the different surfaces and sizes that are available. Get yourself a box of archival paper, put your best images on it, and then put them away in a safe place. Just one of the many ways that Red River Paper can help your photography, not only today, but well into the future. If you want to learn more, click on the tile that's on all the pages of the digital story. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get your house in order, then come back next Tuesday to see me. Until then, bye-bye now.